Spencer Strauss, Session 7, Political Philosophy of Plato, April 19th, 1965.
Now, I think you should close the door, otherwise you will be disturbed. Thank you. Now let us continue. We are at the point where the myth begins. What was the point that you reached?
Yes.
Good. Now, what was the situation? Protagoras had explained what his claim, a stated what his claim is. And Socrates had a certain, and the claim was that he can teach the political art or virtue. It was not quite clear. And Socrates had doubted that virtue is teachable. And Protagoras said, I will answer your question either via a myth or via a logos. And the choice was restored to Protagoras himself. And he said, well, I think it's better to explain it via a myth. This was the point 320 C 8. Now, let us read first the beginning. Yeah.
Once upon a time, there were gods only, and no mortal creatures. But when the destined time came, that these also should be created.
Yeah, but these should come into being. These two should come into being. Now, these two, the mortal races, which means that the gods also had come into being, yeah? I.e. there was a time when there were no gods. Now, is it not difficult? Are the gods not immortal? But this, yes, but this does not mean that they are unborn. Yeah? That doesn't mean, I mean, Jude was born, so there's no difficulty, but there was a time when there were no gods. Hence the time for the coming to being for the mortal races cannot have been appointed by the gods. Surely not the time for the coming to being of the gods cannot have been appointed by the gods. This much is clear. Yeah? This better you would admit.
Surely.
Yeah.
But after something had come into being, it remains forever.
And that you have to address to the Greek mythology.
Well, Plato raises the question, does he answer?
Pardon?
Plato raises the question.
Oh, he doesn't do it. In a way, Protagoras does it. Yeah, but even Protagoras is not fully responsible for a myth. Yeah? So, let us see. Now, begins this again, Mr. Rankin.
But when the destined time came, that these also should come into being. The gods fashioned them out of earth and fire and various mixtures of both elements in the interior of the earth.
Yeah. Now which gods, we are not told, work in the interior of the earth. That means without light, blindness. And these gods are responsible for what is common to all living beings, all animals. Yeah? They create what in present day language would be called living matter. Now, if you would compare this sentence of Protagoras with a parallel in the Timaeus, when Timaeus presents Plato's cosmology, Timaeus 31b to 32c, we would see that Protagoras omits the bond between fire and earth. And this bond, according to the Timaeus, is proportion. You remember his rejection of mathematics in his critique of Hippias in 318e. So there is, in other words, a much more primitive form of cosmology to which Protagoras here alludes. Now, they are formed in the earth, in the interior of the earth. This expression occurs also in the famous noble lie of the Republic, Republic 414 D to E. The human beings, with their instruments and their education, they are formed within the earth, but not by the gods, but by the founders of the city. The founder, according to this myth of the Republic, is a single source of the nature, of the art, and of education. You will see that Protagoras does not assert that. And this source is not divine, but the founders of the city are there. But of course, as a noble, noble lie of the Republic is admittedly a lie, whereas Protagoras doesn't call it explicitly a lie. He says a myth. He must be. Now, in where we left off, yes, go on.
And when they were about to bring them into the light of day, they ordered Prometheus and Epimetheus to equip them and to distribute to them severally their proper qualities. Epimetheus begged Prometheus, let me distribute.
No, he asked him. He bids him. You see, no, there is a constant change from the past tense to the present tense here, which is of some importance. The molding is still taking place. More generally stated, the myth presents as an event of the past what is in fact always going on. This is goes throughout the story. But now let us see. Yes, they ask Prometheus, give the job to Prometheus and Epimetheus, yes?
Let me distribute and do you inspect. Prometheus agreed, and Epimetheus made the distribution. There were some to whom he gave strength without swiftness, while he equipped the weaker with swiftness. Some he armed, and others he left unarmed.
To the others he gave an unarmed nature.
And devised for the latter some other means of preservation, making some large and having their size as a protection, and others small, whose nature was to fly in the air or burrow in the ground. This was to be their way of escape. Thus did he compensate them with the view of preventing any race from becoming extinct. And when he had made sufficient provision against their destruction by one another, he contrived also a means of protecting them against the seasons that come from Zeus, clothing them with close hair and thick skin, sufficient to defend them against the winter cold and able to resist the summer heat, so that they might have a natural bed of their own when they wanted to rest. Also, he furnished them with hooks and hard and calloused skins under their feet. Then he gave them varieties of food, herbs of the soil to some, to others fruits of trees, and to others roots, and to some again he gave other animals as food. And some he made to have few young ones, while those who were their prey were very prolific. And in this manner the race was preserved.
Yes, let us stop here for a moment. So here is a new state. They are no longer the gods, but Epimetheus, the man whose thought comes afterwards, the after-thinker, in contradistinction to Prometheus, the forethinker. Now Epimetheus is, the gods are responsible for what we can call loosely living matter. Epimetheus is responsible for the distinctive faculty, powers, or natures of the various species. He is still working underground, without light, blind, just as a god. Epimetheus attributes, assigns nature, attributing and assigning is in Greek the verb nemein, which is akin to the word nomos, the convention, law. In other words, the myth here reduces the nature to an act of nomos, of nemein. Of course, and this is something distinct from the act of the god, but it is akin to the act of the god because it is also still done underground without lighting. Now we come to the result of this strange cooperation between the god, these gods, we don't know which, and Epimetheus. Yes?
Thus did Epimetheus, not being very wise, forget that he had distributed among the brute animals all the qualities which he had to give. And with
the brute is the nature, literally as the speechless one.
Among the dumb animals, all the qualities which he had to give. And when he came to the race of men, which was still unprovided, he did not know what to do. Now, why
can I really stop you for a moment? What is suggested here then is this. Nature does not take care of man as well as it does of the other animals. Nature is not very wise. The god who left the work to be completed to Epimetheus and Prometheus are not very wise because they are indirectly responsible for that. But we must also not forget that Prometheus himself, the forethinker, is not very wise. Why did he permit his not very wise brother to distribute the power? Well, his lack of wisdom, Prometheus' lack of wisdom is a special one. He is kind-hearted. He is easily swayed by the biddings of others. In Aeschylus' drama, Prometheus Mount, he is presented in the same way. The figure of Io, a woman, has the same effect on Prometheus, which Epimetheus is here. Prometheus is too kind-hearted to be wise. It is not clear, however, whether Prometheus means to present Prometheus himself as lacking in wisdom. In other words, it is possible that Prometheus' lack of wisdom resembles Protagoras' own lack of wisdom, that Protagoras tries to present Prometheus as a wise man, but he is wise in the sense in which Protagoras is wise, not very wise as he is in the secret. The myth, we can say this myth as a whole, shows that the cosmos is not the work of intelligence. Anaxagoras, the first sober man among intoxicated ones, as Aristotle put it, was the first to say that the universe is a work of intelligence. Protagoras does not hold this suggestive view. Now, there is another point. One could, of course, say that man, logos, speech, reason, is man's natural power, which would therefore have been given to him by Epimetheus. This one would could say, but whether this is meant by Protagoras is another matter. The thesis here suggested is nature is the stepmother of man. A thesis which we find somewhat later for the first time in a cynic, a member of the cynic school called Bion, and in Epicurus, also somewhat later. And this is a thesis which was taken up, for example, by John Locke in modern times, and by quite a few others. It is on the whole more characteristic of modern thought than of classical thought, but this only in part. Now let us see the next step of the genesis of the world.
Now, while he was in this perplexity, Prometheus came to inspect the distribution. And he found that the other animals were suitably furnished, but that man alone was naked and shoeless, and had neither bed nor arms of defense. The appointed hour was approaching, when man in his turn was to go forth from the earth into the light of day.
Which implies that whatever the Epimetheus had done was still done on the ground, as I said before.
And Prometheus, not knowing how he could devise man's preservation, stole the wisdom of practicing the...
Steal. This is also present at the end.
Oh. Steal.
In other words, this is truly an eternal process. Also present tense. I did not state it all the time, I just warned it. But in the next sentence it turns again to the past tense. Yes?
Thus man had the wisdom necessary to the support of life. But political wisdom he had not. But that was in the keeping of Zeus. There was no longer any time for Prometheus to enter into the citadel of heaven where Zeus dwelt, who, moreover, had terrible sentinels.
In other words, Prometheus was no longer within in the good grace of Zeus, for reasons which he, which Promethaeus does not state. Yes? And?
But he did enter by stealth into the common workshop of Athena and Hephaestus, in which they used to practice their favorite art, and carried off Hephaestus' art of working by fire, and also the art of Athena, and gave them to man. And in this way, man was well supplied with the means of life. But Prometheus is said to have been actually prosecuted for theft, owing to the blunder of Epimetheus.
Yeah, that is so clear. So we have a new stage, mythically designated by the word, as a figure of Prometheus. The art. In contradistinction to nature. The arts are due not to the unnamed God who mold men underground, nor to the Olympian God, but to Prometheus' action against the Olympian God, and in particular against Zeus. The expression theft is repeated. The fact of a theft, of a crime, is emphasized. In Hesiod, the old poet, sorry, Prometheus steals the fire from Zeus. Protagoras wishes to make clear the radical difference between the other art and the political art or wisdom. The latter only stems from Zeus, as we shall see from the sequel. This description which is here given in of original man in C5-6, shoeless and so on, naked, this is exactly the description given of Eros in Plato's Banquet, 203 C2D. This is not entirely irrelevant, as we can see, because if man's nature is Eros, in the widest sense of the term, meaning the desire for man's completion, for his perfection, if this is his nature, then in a way the art and the laws belong to his nature, which would not be true in a Protagoras scheme. Now, the myth is meant to prove, we must never forget, that virtue can be taught. For this purpose, it must show what virtue is. Hitherto, we have been given only one thing to understand. Virtue is not by nature, because what is by nature is the things which we owe to the gods or Epimetheus. nor, as we learn now, does its virtue an art, like the other arts, because they stand because through Prometheus gift, Prometheus theft. But you see also, in, although it is clear that man is now to move out from underground into the light of the sun, nothing is said about the fact that man actually leaves the underground world, that is left to us to figure out that that's the case. Now, yes?
I understand why in this paragraph it seems to be repeated. First, he says that Prometheus stole fields from Athenus and Athena and wisdom in the arts together with fire.
Yes.
Now, later on in the same paragraph, he says, well, he says that point, man in this way acquires the wisdom of daily life. Now, later on in the paragraph, again, says he has fields, Athenus, and fiery art, and all Athena. Does he refer to the same thing?
So he changed the order. First he said Athena and Hephaestus. No, I'm sorry. In both cases he mentioned Hephaestus first. That's quite true.
Did he refer to the same act twice?
Yeah, I think so. And which in itself means surely empathy. Theft from these two gods. So this is a crime. Man is. You can easily figure that out. But for a crime, man would have been lost. You could not state the thesis of Machiavelli more simply than that. Yeah? Man is compelled to commit crimes in order to live. That's implied. I mean, whether the crime is committed by man, by ordinary man, or by the being acting on man's behalf, namely Prometheus, doesn't make one many difference. Yes?
What is the art of the thing you just referred to? Is that wisdom?
Well, it could be weaving. Weaving. The women's art. It could also be to some extent war. No, not war. It cannot be war in the context. You mustn't forget that Athena is also goddess of war. But you could understand it as a higher art, as distinguished from the more more craftsman-like art of the fire. Yes.
You compare with Pythagoras
that
describing
Yeah, well, according to the now prevailing view, what I suggest is plainly absurd, because they know by a sort of divine revelation that the banquet was written much later than the Protagoras, and therefore there was not yet a thought of it here. But on the other hand, who knows what was in Plato's mind, assuming that he knew the date. He surely knew when he wrote the Symposia, the banquet, where many of the same characters occur, remember? He knew what he had written in the Protagoras, and he could have made retroactively slight changes in the Protagoras to make it drive to the banquet. Yeah? I mean, we simply have to start from the assumption that Plato was as conscious in writing and deliberate as possible.
But we have to check Pythagoras' words
for
Plato's teaching as well as Socrates' words in other words.
Yeah, except, well, sure, to begin with, I mean, if we are quite strict, we can of course never ascribe Socrates' teaching, so to speak, let alone Pythagoras' teaching to Socrates. I expressed it somewhere in an extreme way, but I hope helpful way, by saying that if someone would say that Macbeth is saying life is
tale told by an idiot full of sound and joy,
if someone would say that Shakespeare's opinion, everyone would laugh at him. But if he would quote something nice and pleasant from his Shakespearean character, he would say yes, it's Shakespeare. Yeah? Good. Now this is of course a childish principle, yeah? To say the nice things are the author's views and the unnice things are the views of counters like myself. Now, to begin with, we must apply that to Plato as well. And especially since we know so much that Socrates has been an ironical man, therefore if he says something very nice, he might not have meant it, and if he says something very unnice, he might not have meant it. So we have to use our heads all the time, which is bad, I admit that, but it also has its advantages. Keeps us on our toes, so to say. Yes?
Actually, it's not Socrates
is better,
right? It's Plato. And if Socrates is Plato's
math,
so is everybody else in the dialogue.
Now, how do we know
that
Plato's
math? Because Plato created.
Huh?
This is he created Protagoras and
Hermes. Yeah, all right. Then they all are Plato's math, even the scoundrels.
Okay, then you have to look at it.
Yeah, sure, sure. No,
one man is Socrates a hero, therefore
yeah, well, but we have to see, the point is this, if Plato were to say he's a hero, he could, I mean, he's superior to the others, he could rightly say that it doesn't interest us. If he says so, he may be wrong. But if Socrates proves to be superior, yeah, for example, after all, Protagoras was an outstanding man. You must never forget that. I mean, the greatest names of today would barely be comparable to Protagoras in his time. You know, a very outstanding personality. And when, but if Socrates, who proves to be before our eyes, to be able to confuse, to lick Protagoras, then we see with our own eyes that this Platonic character called Socrates is superior to the other Platonic character called Protagoras. That we see them with our own eyes, and we don't no longer, Plato never says that Socrates is superior to Protagoras, at least not in the dialogue. But if we see it, I mean, we must not be unreasonably skeptical, you know. I mean, if I see that you have a blonde reddish beard, if someone comes and tells me all kinds of things about the deceptions of the senses, would not for one moment make me doubt that you do have such a beard. And I believe if I had any doubt, I would ask Mr. Walker to look at this student whether he has a blonde beard, if I believe he has, or am I confused?
Okay, if you only look at that, you might go around identifying somebody else's knee, only on the basis of that. And that's dangerous. You might find somebody else with a red blonde beard and only look at that and make your identification.
No, yes, no, but the point is,
Socrates involves himself in a good deal of illogic. He is accused constantly and quite justly of pushing people around, of manipulating, of doing verbal argumentation.
Yes, sure, sure.
Merely verbal and not actual.
Yeah, but they are not merely verbal, but all right. All right, but if these other people claim to be the best sophists in the world, and Socrates out-sophists them, then they are licked. That doesn't mean that it is nice to be a sophist, God forbid. But it means only that Socrates could, in a pinch, take care of them. And this may have some advantage, because then we would say, well, if we have to go in for sophistry at all, we prefer Socrates. And then we look whether he doesn't have something maybe which is better than sophistry. Hmm? I mean, that is, we must be very flexible. Yes.
May I just send Plato's hierarchy? People keep noting that thing that the level of argument seems to be below the level on which we believe to move. But this is in the proper tradition of comedy in the ancient world, where serious situations are represented by absurd, easily penetrated exaggeration. Think of Plautus or even Aristophanes.
Yes, sure. But still, even here, but the point is this, that the Platonic dialogues are not in this simple sense comedies. And therefore, Since it is not immediately of any help to us. But on the contrary, I would say, in the case of the comedies, we are too much inclined not to take them seriously enough and simply say, well, these are slapstick scenes which are very amusing, and maybe there are more than slapstick scenes. In a tragedy, you would take them more seriously because then death and guilt and all such other things are involved, and then we are much more respectful, you know, than it would be the case of comedy with all kinds of these disgraceful things which happen in comedy. Now, where were we? Where did we wander off? That was not meant as a criticism of the question, but we have to return now to our text. And we begin now in the last stage. Yes, please.
Now, man, having a share in divinity.
So having acquired a share in a divine portion, divine fate. Meaning, meaning through Prometheus itself. Yeah?
Having acquired a share in a divine lot, was at first the only one of the animals who had any God. Because
now, literally, who believed in God, came to hold God by virtue of his kinship with the God in the singular. Yes?
Oh, because he was of the kindred of the God.
Yes?
And he would raise altars.
No, he would try, would attempt.
Oh, and he would attempt to raise altars and images of them.
Yes. He was of God.
Of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was not long in inventing articulate speech and names, and he also constructed houses and clothes and shoes and beds, and drew sustenance from the earth.
Now let us stop here. Now through Prometheus' time, men came to share in a divine portion. Meaning in the portion, I take it, belonging to Hephaestus and Athena, having these arms. But before that, he alone, of all animals, had already kinship with the God. With which God? And on the basis of what did he have the kinship? I would suggest, without being able to prove that, he had his kinship on the basis of his logos, of his reasoning. Prodamus indirectly reminds us of the absence from his story of an intelligent maker of the universe. Now, he smuggles that intelligent causer in here, in solidarity. The rational animal, man, believes in a rational God, and is qua rational a kindred. You see that worship of the gods precedes speech, but not quite. Therefore he says he tried to set up altars. You know, he couldn't do it properly because he lacked speech in his sense. Now, piety we see then comes in as a virtue here. It's the first virtue proper, we can say, which is mentioned. And it is a pre-political virtue. But it presupposes art. Fundamentally, because according to this view, the gods are by virtue often art. You know, see Laws 889 E3. Also the beginning of the simile of the cave in the Republic. But let us go on. So now we see. Do we have a delivery?
Yeah. Are you suggesting that the original point is that the original kinship of God based on his speech or his speech?
Yeah, but.
Yeah,
the fact that he uses here the God in the singular. means that he cannot have meant the subterraneously written God who molded man. Nor can it refer directly to the Olympian God. At least there is no link between, explicit link between the God and the Olympian God. Why not such a rational cause, like Anaxagoras' intelligence with a capital AI, yet?
Well, because before the theft of Prometheus, which gave him the arts of Hephaestus and Athena, he didn't have speech either, so it would seem that he had absolutely no divine component until the theft.
But now enabled
him to speak and be identified.
Yeah, but would he not, is there not something underlying speech and the art? The condition for the fact that man can acquire art and can acquire speech, could it not be? After all, this fact of man's natural nakedness, which in the radical sense, which Protagoras means it, is this not at the same time also as it were, there is an emptiness, a hole there, which is the place for reason. In this sense, man is potentially rational from the very beginning, even according to this scheme. Yes.
Well, one gets the impression from the beginning of the myth, though, that all of these creatures were created as sort of as blanks, and then were given various powers, and man's power just happened to be,
They are distinguished. They are a gift of Prometheus, and they are distinguished from what they got before. And the others have definite natural powers. Man's powers are, in a sense, all acquired. But there must be something by virtue of which man can acquire. This potentiality must be there, which the others don't have. Man cannot be simply naked, because even if all this nakedness is a very peculiar nakedness, it is rich in potentiality.
Well, it seems the only difficulty would be that this assumes that before any of the qualities or any of the natures were given to the animals by Epimetheus, there was this already, from the very beginning, from the first creation of living matter by the unnamed God, there was a distinction between man and the animals, and that would seem to
Yes, surely it was, because the others, let us say, the other animals are living matter plus, say, instinct. Yeah? He was president. And that then there was the piece of living matter without instinct, and that's man. But the mere fact that the absence of instinct is purely negative thing is also something positive, because it is the basis for the emergence of reason taking the place of it. This, naturally, we have to speculate here a bit because of the extreme gravity of Protagoras' statement. And he is not particularly concerned with that, because he is concerned with making a distinction between nature, art, and something else to which he's turning now. Yeah?
Well, the basis of this very distinction, though, is it would seem that everything that's rational about man simply came from these arts and wasn't a part of nature in the first place.
Yeah, but that he was receptive to the arts in a way in which, say, an elephant would not be receptive, or any other animal.
Well, but you don't mean.
The question I only ask you, what is the kinship of man with the God, and who is that God? This question must be answered. I do not say that I solved it, but show me another solution.
Well, simply that he had the arts, and that's the.
No, the physicist had spoken that he acquired a divine portion. That is what happens through Prometheus. But what about his kinship? His kinship with the God that is not necessarily identical with having acquired the divine portion. That, I believe you would have to give a better answer than I. Yeah.
Is it fair to say on the basis of this discussion that the origin of this logos is not covered in Protagoras?
No, no, no. Yeah, logos is, you can say, divided into, the art on the one hand, language on the other, and something like law at the third place. Yeah. But it is not, it is implied as a unity only in what we find in a man as he came from the hands of Epimetheus.
But since Epimetheus did not give man anything, it must mean that that receptivity came from the God that created living men.
No, they the gods gave nothing. They gave produced only the indifferent living matter of all things. No, but a myth, after all, can never be 100% can never be 100% correct. But there can be a kind of reasonment according to which this absence of any natural faculty means this nakedness means there is a hole. An H-O-L-E, I mean, absence of anything. But being a whole, it can be filled, and it calls as it were for being filled, and acquires an anthropological. Mr. Burns?
The other animals were called Aloga.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And, yeah, they are quite correct to remind me of it. That was the reason why I, it occurred to me that man might here be understood after all as a rational being. And if man is a rational being, the sole rational animal, then of course his kinship with the God would consist in the fact that this single God is the intelligent. Yeah. Good. Thank you very much. Now let us go on very, very later.
Thus provided, mankind at first place dispersed, and there were no citizens. But the consequence was that they were destroyed by the wild beasts, for they were utterly weak in comparison to them, and their arts and crafts were only sufficient to provide them with the means
and
of...
Literally, the craftsmanly art.
Yes.
The art, I mean, the, in other words, the art which they got through Prometheus. The craftsman's art, we can say, yes.
Craftsmanly art were only sufficient to provide them with the means of life, and did not enable them to carry on war against the brutes. Food they had, but not as yet the political art, of which the art of war is a part.
You see, they couldn't wage war because they didn't have the age, the art of war, and they didn't have the art of war because the art of war is a part of the political art, and they did not yet have the political art living in isolation and not together. Yes?
After a while, the desire of collective living and of self-preservation made them found cities. But when they were gathered together, having not the political art, they dealt unjustly with one another and were again in process of dispersion and destruction.
Tom. So man got the craftsmanly art through Prometheus, but not the political technique, the political art. It belongs to a different, that is essentially different from the other art. Hence they could not live together. Hence they could not live. Because man is so built that he cannot live. Man's beginnings, we see, are very imperfect, according to Protagoras. You remember perhaps Protagoras' critique of the wisdom of the ancients. You know, he is superior to Homer, Hesiod, and the others which we have seen before. The whole notion of progress is here somehow in the background. So men need the political art, and they didn't get it from nature nor from Prometheus. How did they get it? Let us see.
Zeus feared that our entire race would be exterminated.
You see, Zeus enters here only very late, after the gods underground, and Epimetheus had done their work. And now he's trying to save the situation. Yes?
And so he sent sent Hermes to mankind, bearing reverence and justice to be the ordering principles of cities and the uniting bonds of friendship.
Yeah. Now Hermes, the god of the thieves, of course, who reminds us of Prometheus' death. And at the same time, if you remember also that Alcibiades was Hermes-like in this title. But he's also the god, emphatically, of the Athenian democracy. He is to bring sense of shame and right. Already, we already know the political art is a divine gift from Zeus himself, not stolen. There is no connection here between Zeus here and that god to whom men are akin, of whom we have read before. Mr. Frankus. Well, because the wild animals threaten them. And they have to be confronted with a tiger. They think maybe if we unite, we have a greater chance of survival. I think that is the most obvious explanation here. And then they couldn't do it because they had to have the capacity of getting along with each other, which they lacked. They were not yet socialized in the sense of present-day political sociology, and that had to be done by Zeus.
Yes. I'm sure Aaron is not a bit of a steward in that man's social life.
Pardon?
He's not a bit of a steward in any way, the man's social
life. You take it very easy, because this truth was denied, surely by such people as Hobbes and Rousseau and so on. Pardon? Yeah, but what? Well, do you believe that this matters depend entirely on climate and here he says, man clearly says, Protagoras, man is not by nature social and by nature, and not even through the invention of the arts does he become social. This is something very special. Sociality. I mean, by the way, the other statements of people like Glaucon in the second book of the Republic, Callicles in the Gorgias, also imply that man is not by nature social. Man's sociality is due to convention. That was a view ordinarily ascribed to the Sophists, and in particular.
Then the question is that was just answered unanswered because it says that, at least in English, the desire of collective living and self-preservation.
Now let me see. They sought to come together, to assemble themselves, and to save themselves by founding cities. But the reason is clear, that an entering society for very powerful motives is something radically different from fundamental sociality. Yeah? I mean, in other words, that society is within us, whether we wish it or whether we have good or bad motives for living in society or for living in isolation, in solitude. But man is by nature social, it means he is under all conditions a social animal, whether he lives in solitude or lives at Times Square at 12 noon. Yes.
Is this to be taken then that the desire is given to men as part of his rational nature, as part of his...
No, a desire is not, it's a thought. It's a little, more little.
So this implies surviving
for... Yes, but not necessarily. That is in no way developed. This seeking is a consequence of the threat by wild animals.
But it's different from the animals who feel no such threat, you are against the nature threat.
That depends. Some of them do live gregariously, as you know. Pardon? A bee and
wolf
ant.
Pack.
Wolf says too, and some quite a few bird races. Aber in Asia, it's social.
Right, we can tell they did so from the beginning, they are made that way. But then.
Yeah, but the point is, man was not made that way. In the case of man, it was necessary to invent society, to found it. That's the point. Good. Where are we now?
322C, about 4. Hermes asks this.
Yes. Good. Now let us go on from here.
Hermes asked Zeus how he should impart justice and reverence among men.
Reverence is, well, you can also sense of shame. Sense of shame, I believe, is better. I do. Now, what are the
other? Justice and the sense of shame among men. Shall I distribute them as the arts are distributed? That is to say, to a few only?
No. That is not much. It must be clearer. As the arts distributed, they are distributed in the following manner. Yeah? And then mean title hood. Yes?
They are distributed in the following manner. One specialist in the art of medicine, or in any other art, being sufficient for a large number of laymen. Shall this be the manner in which I am to distribute justice and the sense of shame among men, or shall I give them to all?
Let's say, in other words, it might be sufficient to have, say, 5 or 6 experts in justice around, and the others are all unjust, and they would take care of the others. You see that Hermes implies that Zeus has no idea of how the arts are distributed. And therefore he explains it, and that's also a little nasty trick. Yes?
To all, says Zeus. I should like them.
Yeah, but you have not tried to imitate the jovial Olympian character in which Zeus tries to thunder from on high. I don't blame you for that, but we must think of that. It must have a terrific effect when he says, oh, all, and all should participate in it, yes?
To all,
yes?
I should like them all to have a share. For cities cannot exist if a few only share in justice and the sense of shame, as in the arts. And further...
As in the case of the other arts, yeah. In other words, only a few have to be tailors or shoemakers and so on. But all must be deep, yes?
And further, make a law by my order that he who has no part in the sense of shame and justice shall be put to death, for he is a plague of the city. And this is the reason, Socrates, why the Athenians and mankind in general, when the question relates to excellence in carpentry or any other mechanical art,
any other craftsmanly art, if that's right to say this,
other craftsmanly art, allow but a few to share in their deliberation. And when anyone else interferes, then, as you say, they object if he be not of the few, which, as I reply, is very natural. But when they meet to deliberate about political excellence or virtue, which proceeds only by way of justice and self-control, they are patient enough of any man who speaks of them, as is also natural, because they think that every man ought to share in this sort of virtue, and that cities could not exist if this were otherwise. I have explained to you, Socrates, the reason of this phenomenon.
Now let us stop here. You see that he comes toward the end of the myth. Twice he has addressed Socrates and has fallen out of this solemn style of mythical delivery. And natural, of course, if you're used in the loose sense, not in the Greek, matter of course, or plausible in a sense. Now, you see, Protagoras has vindicated the Athenian practice as reasonable. But he does not say, as Socrates did, that the Athenians are particularly wise in having that practice. And he says all men do that. So he's not very prudent. He would have had this simple opportunity of paying a compliment to his guests. He doesn't avail himself of it. And he, that's the key point, in contradistinction with Socrates, gives the cause of the Athenian practice. Now what is the cause? What is the cause why the Athenians, in fact all men, demand from every man that he be just and have a sense of shame? What is the cause of that?
The city falls apart.
Yeah, in one sense, but more literally.
The law.
Yeah, the law. Generally speaking, this is due to law. Will you excuse me for one moment? I do not see for that.
It does not serve, it makes sense to say that it is important, especially for someone who loves a woman for the first time, to find out the difference between love and infatuation. And the best way to bring that about is separation. Separation where each meets other people of the other sex, and perhaps it proves to be only an infatuation, and then it's better to find it out in time. I don't see why one should go beyond that. You mean just as one should take a critical look at one's own country by traveling, one should, but he's not yet his mind. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes. Not necessarily. He might also find out after a short while that it was the wrong choice, and then he has to stick to it for the rest of his life. And this is an unwise thing to do, and therefore he suggests wisely a separation of some time, and then in order to make the separation meaningful, to travel, and to travel intelligently. And that is what he's doing.
Of course, it could have been said that the travel, because
of stuff,
it will be more
purposeful
to be able to keep his mind on the object of his travel, as opposed to picking up the
purple piece. Yes, sure. Yeah, in other words, he has an object, because he has in mind to find the most desirable country where to settle this city. Sure. Mr. Johnson.
Well, I was going to
get away
from that book of the travel work.
Yes, Sophie and
in both parts of this book.
In which sense?
Well, I was thinking in the sense of that look at the whole introduction of Sophie as merely a function, necessary function for moving into the unit of the new development. Something which in a sense might be put up with, but not in the sense.
Oh no, that you cannot say. And on the contrary, I try to show that Rousseau pulls the stages of women, not only truly beyond Aristotle, but I think also beyond what Plato seriously meant. I think when the only thing which is doubt is true that every political philosopher is of course compelled to think not only about the political association but also about the controversy. But if in the subject matter there doesn't exist any influence or dependence. The matter of free choice is applied not only to the wife but also to the poet. Is this what you meant? Yeah. So there is something to that. That is quite true. That is true. I mean, in this case of the particularly say that a man, he can choose his country as much as everyone can choose that. That is the decision to play.
One thing I was wondering if we focus on the written book of Tolkien alone, when you think that an Emile is another leader of the end, it's necessarily
real, it's the same thing that the book. No, he's incomplete without Sophie. And to say nothing of this fact, for example, the difference of education between the two, between Emile and Sophie, throws great light retroactively on Emile's education, especially in the question of religious education. Oh no, that is not an afterthought. That's, I think, essential to the argument.
But
I believe what you mean is this, that the text of the fire on which the whole thing is ultimately based is not necessary in the way in which it's a disciple of food, for example. Yes? That's me. Very well. And this would mean that men of another kind than a need would not need to marry. Yes? Do you mean that? That is also true. In other words, that is one other point of the difference between Rousseau, who was in no serious sense of the word marriage. Did he marry? At the end, I see. But this was, I think, pure more administrative. Hmm? No, he liked her in his way, but surely she was not a true companion. Yeah, I know, but in a very limited manner. Yeah.
We probably won't get to this today, but I would just like to insert a question about whether or not Emile can, in the end, have free choice regarding his name. It seems to me that if he had raised